You may have noticed our new branding and our fabulous new website, thestagechefpodcast.com. Well, as musicians, do you ever finish your song, EP, album, really happy with what you created, but think, what now? What's next? What visuals suit the work I've created? What about the graphic design? Or even worse, you hire a photographer who you spend money on, but they don't quite land the vibe you're going for. Well, the answer is Who's Hughes, which is run by the creative genius that is Bastien Hughes, who is a brilliant musician in his own right and will take your nuanced story and create a vision around it. Such a clever process that Bastien has designed and really is the answer to your kind of what's next question. So if you head to bastienhughes.com, that's bastienhughes.com, or Instagram, Bastien Hughes, the first five people who mention Stage Left will get a free branding consultation session with him, which I cannot tell you, you know, how valuable that stuff is, really. So do go over to bastienhughes.com, because many, many times we can get sucked into a world of doing take after take or endlessly tweaking mixes for our work of art we've created and then just think, well, what's next? What now? Well, bastienhughes.com is your answer, because it's a safe, trusted pair of hands for the next stage of your work of art.
Hey everyone, it's Bastien. We've got a special bonus episode for you today where Chris is interviewed by Simon's Universe of Music. Enjoy.
Chris, thank you very much for your time. With having your podcast, just tell us a little bit like how long you've been going and what it means to you.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Simon, and I'm glad to be part of your universe. So my name is Chris Simpson, and I've hosted something called the Stage Left Podcast for, it's now 6 years. I think it was around the end of March, and beginning of April, 6 years ago, that I interviewed a guy called Mike Rowe, who was the keyboardist for Oasis for some period, and also plays now with Noel Gallagher in Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. Also played with Dave Gilmour and Sheryl Crow and lots of other people as well. And I've been doing this podcast for six years to provide free educational content for young musicians entering the music industry, because I noticed I was starting to see a pattern that a lot of musicians who seem to be producing really high quality art, people like David Bowie, people like Damon Albarn, people like Radiohead, quite a lot of them, not all, were going to university, and they were university graduates. And I kind of thought that's really unfair when the tuition fees were increased in the UK, that perhaps there could be a David Bowie or Damon Albarn or someone like people from Radiohead who couldn't afford to go to university and therefore couldn't get the educational content or experience that might have helped them on their way. So I thought, well, what about if I produce kind of a portfolio of work, which is essentially a lot of very in-depth interviews with well-known musicians, so that, you know, upcoming musicians can listen to that and see that as the kind of wisdom and guidance for free that they otherwise might have got in another era from perhaps going to university. And I wanted to always interview the people who stage left, so not in the spotlight. So kind of telling the stories of the unsung heroes, if you like.
I think, Chris, for anyone out there who is a young musician, it is absolutely the best. Because for when you're going out and buying the record, you know, yeah, you can just listen to the track. But, you know, the people that put that in that work, you know, it's really important.
We have done a few in the last year. I try to do as many of them face-to-face as I can, which has been limited. But then again, it's created an opportunity in the last year to do some more, a bit like we're doing now, which is remote, because it's gone back to what the podcast initially was, which was a lot of transatlantic appeal. So we had like Gail Ann Dorsey on, who's Bowie's bassist, and she's based in New York. We had Miles Copeland on recently, who's Sting's manager and manager of the Police, and he signed REM to Iris Records. He's in LA. So actually it's kind of enabled me to do podcasts with people I otherwise wouldn't have been able to geographically. So yeah, it's been an interesting year. There's a lot of horror stories I'm hearing from the music industry, like people in household name bands who you would listen to, you probably mentioned on your shows before, who are like really struggling, because as you know, if you don't have a songwriting royalty, you don't get a huge amount from the music industry unless you're playing live.
Sure.
And if you're not playing live, like, you know, there isn't really any income. So, you know, I know people who are doing other work at the moment and looking to other careers right now, who otherwise would have been in very senior positions or very high up the bill on the pyramid stage at Glastonbury. You know, so this is what the reality of the world is at the moment. My hope is that there will be such an appetite for gigs when things go back to normal that actually they'll end up playing probably the same amount of gigs they ever would have done anyway. But because so instead of doing one night in a city, they'll do three nights because there'll be the appetite and then moving on. So they'll just kind of catch up that way. That's what I hope. But it's been, you know, it's been a difficult time for everyone, this pandemic. I don't think there's anyone who's not been impacted by it. We had Sybil Bell on the podcast not so long ago, and she's released a film called Long and Winding Road, which is about small venues and the importance of those as a breeding ground, if you like, for young musicians and bands to be able to make mistakes and to fail. You can't just go get to the level of playing Wembley Stadium or Wembley Arena or Madison Square Gardens in the same way as, you know, I know that you're a chef. The first time you would have cooked up a particular recipe, things would have gone wrong and you would have learned from it.
Yeah.
And so she argues the importance of the small venues are basically it's like a place where you can experiment, you know, young bands playing their first gigs, get things wrong, learn from it so that they eventually become the level that we will then all go to their gigs and love them. And I do worry about those small venues, and they are dependent on a lot of, you know, funding, unfortunately. And, you know, her message, and I always share this message, is that, you know, how often do we all go to independent, you know, small gigs? You know, whatever that figure is, double it. So if you go once a year, go twice a year. If you go twice a year, go four times a year. If you go once a month, go twice a month. And that will really, really help grassroots music if you can just double the amount of times you go to your kind of local or small venues to check out small bands.
But what I would really like is for bands that I'm reaching out to say, like, one night a month is where Simon's Universe of Music put on a night and get people out to see, like, live music, where you can have, like, two bands on, three bands on. Yeah, and get people out to see them, you know? And that's from, it doesn't matter where they're from, but, you know, if they can get there and they can put on a gig. And it's not about money. It's about people seeing the band that they can think, oh, I like them, so I'm going to get their music and I'm going to follow them and I'll become a fan of theirs. And you try and spread it like wildfire.
I think it's very important to do things like that for young bands, because I fear that I always have this thing, right, which is, can you imagine all the wonderful music? So all the great bands we've ever listened to, can you think of all the wonderful music that was written and we just never heard it because bands lost faith because no one came to their gigs?
Yeah.
There's probably like another Beatles out there or like another Pink Floyd or, you know, who just were like, fuck this, no one's turning up to our gigs. I've actually got to pay my bills. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to make that decision to go and do another job.
Sure.
And the world lost that music. We never heard that music. And I don't actually always agree with the whole thing that the, you know, the cream will always rise to the top. I think that, you know, you could have some brilliant, brilliant Richard Ashcroft level songwriter who, you know, if the you know, the rent is late and the landlord's banging on the door and, you know, he's got to pay his bills, he eventually might go into something else and we never hear that music again, regardless of how good it is. Even if it was amazing, it's just probably lost on some kind of, you know, MySpace account from 15 years ago or some kind of Bandcamp now. So I think anything you can do to draw people to support young bands is worthwhile. You know, if those bands go on and make it and, you know, do some great stuff, they'll always remember you for having had that, you know, giving them that leg up. So I think we can't do too much for young musicians. Like, there's not like, you know, we can just constantly try and give them the leg up. And, you know, we can take satisfaction that they've gone on and, you know, you supported them in some way, you know, through their development. It's hard. I mean, it's always been hard for young bands. One thing a friend said to me a few years ago, I was kind of, you know, when you turn up to another gig and there's no one there and that kind of thing, it's just empty rooms, which does happen sometimes. He made the point that there are so many distractions these days for us. And I'm not talking about phones, but I'm talking about, like, there's so much entertainment that is pretty much free that, you know, it used to be a case that going to a gig, there was three channels on TV and it's like, okay, there's nothing on tonight. What else are we going to do? Oh, let's go to a gig. Well, now there's a million channels.
Yeah.
There's everything on Netflix. There's every box set ever. And there's, you know, loads of so many different things you can do in life that you didn't necessarily have access to in regards to entertainment. But I think that is one of the problems why venues are kind of empty a lot, I would say, is because people have got more choice and choosing other things to do, unfortunately.
Yeah. I suppose. And the other thing is when it comes down to what people are earning and how much they can afford to spend on a night out and have choice. It's just like, I can only go by myself, Chris, where, you know, I left school and I went straight into work at 16. So I was earning, I've always earned. And it was just like, that's what I spent my money on. It's like going to gigs, you know, buying the enemy, buying the albums, you know, but being just like from having that record and then knowing at the back of the enemy where they would have like all the tours and that, and go, right, when they get released at 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm picking up that phone or whatever and I'm getting them tickets and it's going to be amazing. I hope people over the next few years or so are still going to think like that.
I think one thing to bear in mind is if you think of business models for a particular band,
yes.
If you, if a ticket for a gig is 70 quid, because you probably listen to their music for free, or most people listening to the music for free, like, you know, there used to be this thing in the music industry, which used to be, if you can make £100 out of every fan per year, that was the business model, right? So however many fans you've got, make £100 from them. So it might be 30 quid for a gig ticket, you know, 20 quid for a t-shirt, you know, here's some extra merchandise, whatever it might be, and then get it up to 100 quid. Let's say it's less than that, say 75 quid. I genuinely think that music fans are not paying more money to see their artists, the bands they like at gigs, in a way, because they listen to the music for free. So for if you wanted to go and see Noel Gallagher, you know, and he charges 60 quid for a ticket. Okay, in the past, it might be 35, 40, but yeah. In the past, almost all the people in the audience would have bought the album for 15 or 20 quid.
Yeah.
Right? So you just kind of, it's the same amount of money. So I think that's why prices have gone up. So I don't think actually music fans are in any way shortchanged. You can literally, unfortunately, go on to Spotify for £10 a month and you have the library of world music at your fingertips, which is absolutely unbelievable. It's fantastic, I have to say, for the consumer. So, like, it's awful for the artist. It's fucking terrible for the artist. But yeah. For the consumer, it's amazing. So I'm not in the camp of, like, going, oh, gig prices are too much. It's like, that's the only fucking way they're going to earn money, because sure. The rest of us are listening to their stuff for free. So I'm kind of okay with that. You know, there's some interesting stuff around kind of demand for gigs and stuff like that now. So, like, there's quite an interesting threshold about when it's worthwhile putting on another night. So, you know, there are some bands who will really, they'll put on, you know, they could put on more nights, or they can cram as many people in as they possibly can and then just hold it as one night to keep the cost down than having to do a second night to, like, slightly fewer people and stuff like that. So I think that's kind of interesting as well. And, you know, yeah. Spotify has actually helped artists. You know, a friend of mine is, she's in quite a band doing quite well, and they will choose where they go on tour in Europe based on how many listens they get in different cities on Spotify.
Right.
Which makes perfect sense, because
yeah.
They're a band who would sell out, say, the Garage in London, and they'll sell out kind of like half-decent sized venues in Europe. But for some reason, there'll be just one city in Europe that just doesn't listen to her. And it's like, okay, well, that's fair enough. Well, let's maybe just dodge there in that case and just focus on making it as efficient for them to make money that they can play the same size venues. Because, you know, I've heard loads of examples of bands playing massive gigs on a Saturday in one country, going to the next country, and they're playing like to an empty room. So you, that data is kind of useful for artists as well, that Spotify provides. Sure. But gig prices, I'd only have an issue with the prices going up if we were all paying for albums.
Or the majority aren't. Yeah. Put it this way, Chris. You know with me, yeah, if Noel Gallagher's playing three nights in a place where I'm, you know, let's say down the road in Newcastle, yeah, I'm going to the three nights because of the fan that I am. It's just like, you know, and coming to him, I've seen the High Flying Birds 10 times, right? He's my favourite songwriter in the world, from the my favourite band in the world. And I can honestly say for the 10 times that I've seen him, Chris, I've never been disappointed. I've paid the money to get, you know, if it's down in London or, you know, when I first started coming up north to see Susanna, I went to the Palladium show on my own and stayed in a hotel and obviously paid. I was living in south of Birmingham at the time.
I wish I knew you then. I have to say, this is a terrible thing. I was on the guest list for that night, the Palladium show, and it was fantastic. It was an after party and everything. It was fantastic. It's a shame I didn't know you then because I was at the same night and that was a beautiful evening, wasn't it?
It was.
What a venue the Palladium is. And,
well,
fantastic night.
Yeah, I can tell you about, I can honestly tell you about that. So my grandmother used to be principal dancer at the Royal Ballet in London, right? And she became a choreographer and she worked in that theatre. And with me being the Norwich fan that I am, it was the season that they won the league a couple of seasons ago. So that was my promotion party to myself, right? So I had one ticket, got the hotel, got a train down, and I was sat in the opposite, in the middle, in the circle bit, right? And Sarah was sat like a few rows in front of us, Noel's missus, with the kids and, you know, and that. When she was walking up, I tootled on over and I said, "Oh, Sarah, pleased to meet you. I've come from Birmingham on my own. I just want to say your husband is the biggest inspiration in my life." And she was like, "Oh, thank you. I'm Sarah. Pleased to meet you." And that was just like, you know, that to me, being in that building, seeing him and my family and meeting her. And also, I think after Gaz had played in the interval before Noel came on, I went outside for a cigarette. And Jay Sharrock was outside and I went and spoke to him for a bit. I said, "All right, how are you doing? What you been up to and all of that?" We had a bit of a chat and that was it. But after the gig, I went round the back to see if anyone was about. And like the backstage was opening, you could see Jess and YC and that. And I think Gemma.
I was with Jess. That I was stood with Jess then backstage at that exact point that night. That we must have been passing ships.
Yeah, I reckon we would have been passing ships, and we would have seen each other. I cannot deny, obviously, with doing this, it is my goal and the ultimate achievement to obviously one day, obviously meet the man I idolise the most. Just to say thank you for giving so much to my life, you know, with his music, his and everything.
I'm lucky I've met Noel a few times, I think. Yeah, and he's a character who, you know, for everything that you just said about him, it's the same with me. Like he shapes everything. I mean, the stage left. You know, where did he stand on stage for Oasis? Right, the stage left.
Sure.
So, yeah, he shaped everything that I do. And it's interesting because I'm very close to a lot of the members of the band. Jess has played a gig in my lounge twice.
No way.
And so it's interesting to, you know what it's like to work from Noel from their perspective. What I'm glad with is I know other bands that I've loved that when I've heard a bit more what they're like, I've kind of, the magic has disappeared slightly.
I understand that.
And I've seen
that.
The other side of the curtain. He's magic. You know, I've had some very lucky experiences. So I was part of Noel's touring party to Rome when they supported U2, which was amazing. That's when I interviewed Russ.
Right.
That was probably one of the most kind of dramatic days of my life, actually, because a lot happened that day. It was quite, you know, I've talked about on the podcast quite a lot. And that was very cool. And, you know, being with them, Bob and Paul and that kind of thing. It's kind of meeting up with people who've been on the podcast in the past, that kind of thing. That was cool. I was lucky to be at the Palladium on the guest list as well, which was a special night. And afterwards, it was kind of really cool because a guy I've wanted on the podcast for a few years, a guy called Chris Sharrock, who drums for Noel's band.
Yes.
And he said something, I have to say, this might seem a bit of an odd thing for me to say because it's slightly a bit of an odd thing to say, but I'd say one of the proudest moments of my life is seeing him and saying, "You're right, Chris, I'm Chris from the Stage Podcast." And he went, "Oh, I hear your name everywhere from the guys." I was like, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, they always say, you've got to go on his podcast and say what a nice guy you are." And I was like, how cool is that? That they like that. That's his kind of interpretation of me having not met me. And then obviously he met me and he thought I was an arsehole. No, he didn't. He then spent he basically said the reason he doesn't do it is he said he's really private. And he said that once I feel a bit like this interview now, if I say something that I kind of later regret, it's out there, it's gone. And that was his point. He said, like, once it's gone. And I said, well, you know, that's fine. Let's just respect that. And I'm quite close to his nephew. So you mentioned Jay Sharrock. One of my best mates is Jim Sharrock, who's Jay's cousin. And I saw Jay that night as well, actually. I know exactly where you were sat because I saw him by his seat.
Yeah.
So I ended up speaking to Chris and he said, come over and chat with us. And I've got some great photos. And we ended up chatting for about an hour. And at the end, he went, "We should record that as a podcast, shouldn't we?" And I was like, "Yes, we should have." And he said, "Just get my number off Jim and we'll hang out next time we're in Liverpool." So I'm sure that will be something that will happen at some point, and you know, I'll see him at some point. But he's a really nice guy. He's just really private.
Yeah.
And I just gotta respect that. He doesn't really want to share too much. But that was kind of a cool night. So yeah, Noel is a brilliant songwriter. I think it's interesting what he's been doing with EPs, and I think it's really interesting that his most experimental stuff he has done has been released as an EP or been released as EPs, which suggests to me that maybe he didn't quite have the confidence to do experimental stuff that would be then be able to be found as an album later on. So it's almost like the safety net of, okay, I'll do experimental stuff, but I'll release them as EPs. Because if they don't land or they age badly, they can kind of disappear into the ether a little bit. I think it was interesting that basically he recorded an album, but he released them as three EPs, as like, you know, equates to like 10, 11, 12 tracks, doesn't it? That's only my opinion.
I'm really interested in what's going to happen next, because obviously with the EPs, Chris, and with him doing that kind of sound, but is it going to be something that he brings out where he sort of goes back to his original kind of sound of like when the first High Flying Birds came out? Or is he still going to carry on with this kind of sound that he's got now? And I'm really interested to see of how it's going to work, because the reason why I'm interested in how it's going to work is what's going to be the perception by the fans when it comes out and he's going to say, "Oh yeah, it's fucking great. It's brilliant. It's some of the best stuff I've ever done. You know what? And I don't give a fuck what anybody thinks," right? But, and of course, someone like me, so I'm going to think, "You know what, Noel? Yeah, you know what? You're right." But I know for when you switch on like your mobile phone and you go on the internet or do whatever, there's going to be Oasis fans that are going to say, "It's fucking shit. It's rubbish. You know what? Just go back to what you were doing." I hope that it's really great, you know, and I hope people are still on board.
I've always found Noel most interesting when he has a point to prove. So I think that he was at his best when Oasis were on, you know, those first two or three, and I'd include fourth album, but, you know, Master Plan I'm talking about there.
Sure.
And I remember there was a time that I went to a lot of Oasis gigs and felt that he looked quite unhappy on stage. And at the time I thought it was him being cool, but actually I think he was really quite unfulfilled in that decade, particularly the latter part of the decade. Creatively, I think he was really, really unfulfilled.
Yeah.
I remember being at the Royal Albert Hall gig and he just looked like he just didn't want to be there. And that kind of pissed me off because I spent a lot of money on those tickets, right? And I think then he started High Flying Birds and it was like, right, I'm going solo now. So, and I think he really made a good point with like the first first album. And I think he's been consistently good. Like, I don't think there's a massive drop off at all in anything he's done.
No.
I think what's changed in the last 2 years is Liam's career has gone way beyond expectations of anyone, including any of kind of Liam's circle or Liam himself, I think, expected. So I think that's kind of, it might make Noel a bit more, I've got a point to prove again. So I think what he'll do next could be something that is quite likely to be liked by Oasis fans.
Well, that's pretty excellent.
I might be wrong, but I think having done the experimental stuff on the EPs, I think we'll be listening to something that is to go, hey, don't forget about me, by the way. I'm the guy who wrote these and he's a fucking great song.
Yeah.
I think that's what we'll see next, because he's, you know, you had Noel really smashing it when BDI were kind of doing stuff as well for those few years.
Yeah.
So Liam's solo career at the moment is astronomical. It's massive in context. So, and Noel's every single album he's done has gone to number one.
Absolutely.
So he's doing great. But I just think he now might want to be a bit like, right, I'm back.
Yeah. And to me, that when you say that, Chris, that's really exciting, because it's just like, you know what? That is what we really want. That's him. When I saw him in Newcastle on the last tour for He Built the Moon, sorry, right? When he'd done like the right stuff, yeah, and the sound of that tune and with the band that he's got, I was just like, this is it. This is top class music. Yeah, if he's thinking in his mind where, you know what, now's the time to go, like, I'm gonna show you that I'm the fucking best, then, you know what, I'm really proud to be a fan of his, because that's always what I want from him, because to me he is the best. And it's just like with Liam and that, I saw BDI 3 times, right? And I've not seen Liam solo yet. Hopefully I will do the next time round. But there's been... I saw Oasis, like, you know, 9 times, but there's been nothing really draw me in to see him, because it's just like I want a bit more from Liam. And what's your opinion on where you think Liam's going with his band and his songwriting, Chris?
I love Liam, and I think he's done great in the last couple of years. I think the best decision he made was to be transparent and say, you know what, I'm actually not the best songwriter, so we're going to hire in other songwriters to do this. And by the way, do you know Elvis did that, and Frank Sinatra, and loads of other people? So I'm just going to focus on my voice.
Sure.
Absolutely the best decision he made, and owned it. He didn't kind of like, you know, scuttle into the kind of corner and just say, oh, by the way, no, I didn't write this one. He kind of owned it. And then from there, I think his band are fucking amazing individually. Christian Madden is an absolutely outrageous pianist and Hammond player, hugely respected in his field, who has written, I mean, for your viewers, check out a song called Everybody Get In Line by Christian Madden. It is like the number one banging tune I put on at any party, at any time I DJ, anything like that, I'll always put that track on. Whether he's been utilised as much as he might be, I don't think some of, you know, the songs that Liam does and the Oasis songs get an opportunity to really show off that kind of like capability on a piano or a keyboard. But Christian, he could write Liam's next album, and that's not going to happen. But I think, like, I know people in his circle have gone, you could write one or two songs for his next album. Like, he's fucking amazing. Dan McDougall, the drummer, he's incredible. He's not just a drummer though. His career path is way beyond just being Liam Gallagher's drummer. He's an incredible producer. He's an incredible writer. He's working with people who, like Bruno Major and others who are, Dan McDougall, this won't be the peak of his career playing drums for Liam Gallagher at all. He wants to be remembered as an Ivor Novello winning songwriter. I think he is as important to Liam as Gem and Andy were in BDI, and in some ways as Noel was in Oasis. So I think Liam needs to have a strong musical person with the proper musical lexicon and the proper musical, you know, technical capabilities for Liam to be at the best, because he's a brilliant singer, obviously. He's got an idea for a tune and that kind of thing, but he needs someone with the particular abilities to be able to realise what he wants, right? And that was Noel in Oasis. Like, Noel was the person who took care of that. When Noel left, then Andy and Kim were the kind of, right, okay, this is what we want to do, you guys go and do it.
Sure.
When he was in solo, like, I know Dan is that person in that band. And if Dan was to choose to leave, or, you know, things change in Dan's career and he went a different direction, I think, you know, and Liam would replace him, but I think he'd be the person he'd least like to leave the band, because Dan is far more than just a drummer. You've then got Jay Mailer, who is on guitar. Jay's a lovely guy. He came to one of my nights at the Grouch Show a while ago, and he's married to Leah Starkey, who's They've got triplets. And they had a babysit that night. And Jay's a top guy, because he came up, again, it was actually Ian Brody introduced me to Jay. And Jay went, this was another cool moment where he said, call me the lovely Chris. He says, oh, the lovely Chris. And he sent a text message afterwards, it's the lovely Chris. And he said, and I said, oh, we had this episode with Tony Visconti. And he cut across me and he went, Zach was telling me about that. Which is even more mental, because Zach Starkey is someone I've never even met or spoken to and lives in Australia now. And he's like, yeah, Zach was telling me about that. So that was like a special moment. And then my partner and I mean, I know you're a chef by trade.
Yes.
My partner's also a chef. And we did these things called supper clubs where, and I'm going off topic here, but I'll bring it back around.
That's good.
Where we would get well-known musicians to play in our lounge, and my partner would cook a 5-course meal to understand. And we paid, and so like Jess did it. Who else? We had loads of, She Drew the Gun did it. We had John Woff from the 1975 do it, loads of people. And we'd sell tickets for, you know, to fans, right? And we'd do that in our lounge. And Jay was going to do it, because Gen has said that Jay is one of the best songwriters you could ever meet. He said he's unbelievable, but he doesn't do anything with his songs. And so, like, Jay was going to do it. And we come out, we stood by the toilets having a chat, me and my partner, and Leah Starkey comes out and she went, I've heard about you guys and what you do. Now, here's what she did. She walked out. She looked at me. She kissed me on the lips, then turned to my partner, kissed her on the lips and said, I've heard about what you do. It sounds so cool. I can't wait to come around. And I remember thinking, holy fuck, I've got Beatles DNA. I've got Beatles DNA in me right now. I need to get someone, give me a guitar. I need to write a song right now. I've got Beatles DNA in me right now. And it hasn't happened yet for a few reasons, which I can't go into. But yeah, so Jay's a really capable guitarist and is a top guy. Mike, I've not met, but I know people who worked with Mike, and he's a good guitarist as well. And I think that's pretty much most of his band. And you know, Liam's...
Well, I was going to come to Drew.
He's got Simon Aldred writing. Drew as well. Yes, I've met Drew a couple of times. Simon Aldred, from Terry Ghost, who are a fucking great band. He writes a lot of Liam's songs. And then also you've got the guy, you know, the songwriter is Andrew, I can't remember his name now, but he's won an Oscar. He's an Oscar-winning songwriter who is writing songs for Liam Gallagher. That is a winning combination. Liam's voice and an Oscar-winning songwriter. So, you know, Liam's doing great. And, you know, I was very lucky, again, at Finsbury Park gigs. We were on a guest list for that. And he only had 20 spaces on his guest list, and his son took up most of them. And I got one. And so my partner, we had to buy a ticket somewhere else and get backstage elsewhere. But he's surrounded by good people, Liam. That's something really important to know.
Yes.
And there was this really beautiful moment, actually, where we were talking to this person who I didn't know who she was, but she was with Christian and Dan. And it was kind of long enough conversation, but by the end, we had a couple of drinks while Rich Ashcroft was on. And she went, "Oh, nice to meet you. Hope to meet you again." And then she walked off. And we just thought, oh, she was nice. Don't know what she does. She's obviously like some roadie or something to do with, you know, production or something like that. And then an hour and a half later, midway through Liam's set, he's doing whatever. And he's got a cellist up on there playing all the famous parts. And me and my partner were like, "Oh, that was her. That's the cello player playing that part." So he's surrounded by really good, nice people. And I think his career is doing way, way beyond what was expected, given if you took kind of BDI as a, you know, as a measurement of where things were. And I think the root cause of that was the One Love concert that he did when he turned up at the last minute.
Sure.
The reason that was important was because that audience were generally, they're Ariana Grande young fans, right, who were impacted by the awful atrocity that had occurred. And you then had this guy coming in his 40s, and you think, oh, that wouldn't normally land. But he thankfully sounded so youthful. He looked youthful, and he looked cool, and he performed great. And even like Katy Perry afterwards was going up to him and saying, "You're just like the coolest guy." And I think he then got a new wave of fans, which when my mate Jed, who's a drummer in my band, he's been to Oasis gigs back in the day, like, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, he got tickets to go and see Liam at Ali Pali. And he said there's this really weird thing where he said there was all these young fans who were going mad for new Liam songs that Jed didn't know. And then Liam would do Rocking Chair, and he and his mates would go absolutely nuts, going, "Holy fuck, Liam's doing Rocking Chair. This is amazing," jumping up and down, singing. And he'd look around, and all these young fans were like, "What's this? I don't know this." So he's got this interesting dynamic of two groups of fans that he's basically, there hasn't been someone of this generation who come and captured the attention of young people. And I think Liam's actually done a bit of that despite the age gap, which is really interesting. So his career is going great, in my opinion. And
I will. There's no doubt about it, I will. I mean, I'm sure, like, Chris, we're the same age. I mean, like, you know, I've turned 40 this year, and it's just like from the age of like 14, 15, he's probably been the most important person in my life, as in like celebrity, like rock star, you know, to have the impact of like, you know, I'm still wearing Pretty Green. It's just like, you know, and I probably always will. He has been the most influence on like obviously fashion, hair, style, culture, everything. And for him to still have an impact on people now, just being him, because I mean, for Oasis, what was it that made people buy a ticket to see Oasis? It was probably him, because of the impact that he had when he was on that microphone and his singing them songs, you know, to draw the thousands and thousands of people in. Yeah, you've got the tunes, but that man and that voice and that stardom is pretty surreal.
An Oasis gig is so exciting. And I would say, but like Liam, I mean, that's why you go to Liam gig. Like, it's not that far off. Like, he's still fucking playing Slide Away, and some might say, like, you know, if you look at the set list he did at Finsbury Park, The second half, he just dropped his solo material and was like supersonic into Some Might Say into Champagne Supernova, Champagne Supernova into whatever. It was just basically an Oasis gig, but, you know, with, you know, the stage left musicians weren't members of Oasis, but it was not quite as exciting, but it was thrilling, you know. And there's always been, you know, I remember when you talked about earlier, looking back at NME and seeing when the tickets go on sale and stuff. And I remember, you know, being 16 and, it would have been about 16 and making sure my friends came over for 9 o'clock. So we had 3 telephones to try and get tickets for Wembley Stadium, which was Standing on the Shoulders gigs, which again, it was like the first gigs that Kim and Annie played.
Sure.
And getting tickets for both nights and just that weekend being incredibly like emotional, but like unbelievable excitement, like hysteria. It felt like having tickets to like the World Cup final. That's what it felt like the crowd beforehand and stuff. It was just brilliant. And then to go back the second night as well. And the first time I stood and experienced what a mosh pit was, and I didn't know what a mosh pit was. And it was during the Happy Mondays because they supported. And I thought, like, no kidding, I thought I was going to die. I thought there'd been some kind of disaster. Not to use it as a throwaway comment, but I thought it was like Hillsborough thing was happening. I was like, there's such a crush that people can't. And I was, I'm little as it is anyway, let alone then. And like been taken by this wave, and I fucking hated it. It gave me a panic attack and stuff. Thankfully, by the time Oasis came on, I'd kind of forgotten about it and got to a space that I wasn't quite as involved.
Sure.
And then the second night we sat. Liam is... I agree with you, everything you said. You know, everything on my camera right now, every item, pretty much. I was just thinking as you said that, like, probably wouldn't be there if Liam Gallagher hadn't come into my life in the same way as he did to you. Like, pretty much every single item in my room right now, indirectly. My haircut.
Yeah.
Everything.
Like, it's just everything about, you know, I can remember being like 15 or so and getting like a suede jacket for like a fiver in a charity shop. And it was just be like, I'm going to get it because he would, you know, the style and the influence of obviously who they idolize. And it's just like the other thing, it's just like, I love how they've taken bits from so many greats of the 1960s and the 70s and all of the sounds and the fashions and everything, because being a teenager in the 90s, it was just like, to me, I'm thinking like now, Chris, it's just like people go on about the 60s and how great the 60s were and they had this, that and the other. But you know what? I honestly think the 90s are just as important because of obviously the charts and fashion and the way the world was moving. The internet was just coming in. It was a surreal time. And, being a teenager at that time, I think it's important now that people, you know, look back and how great that time was, you know, pretty incredible.
It's hard to compare, having not lived through both. I mean, 60s, I don't know about that, because, I mean, the 90s were fucking brilliant, like Euro 96 and stuff like that, and I'm very close to, like, one of our best mates is Riley, who's going to be playing a lot of shows with Lightning Seeds this summer during the Euros and stuff like that, because Life of Riley is written by him and he's in the Lightning Seeds. I think the slight difference with the 60s, though, is because the Cold War was going on, people thought the world was going to end any moment, and so... like just promiscuous sex and drug taking was just kind of reasonably like okay to do because the world was going to end. Whereas I think when people did that in the 90s, it's probably slightly less of that and slightly different drugs people took.
Yes.
And it's just a case of like coming from a place of actually being a bit angry with what had happened in the UK in the previous kind of era under Thatcher. So I think there was definitely a sense of euphoria in the 90s, a bit of escapism and hope that New Labour brought, which didn't actually kind of play out so much in the end. But I think to compare it to the 60s, I think the 60s was different because the Cold War was going on. And so there was a sense that an atomic bomb, that, you know, the fingers over the button the whole time. So do you know what? We better fuck and take acid as much as we can whilst we still can. And then, if you know, and the Beatles came about, and then fucking JFK got shot, and then, you know, all the stuff that, you know, happened, you know, with the moon landing and shit like that. Like, yeah, I'd probably say I probably prefer to live through the 60s and 90s, but the 90s were definitely fucking amazing. But I wonder if every year I says that. So if we're born 10 years before, do you reckon we'd be sat here now going, oh, well, the 80s was good?
I know. It's like being born in 1981 and only now watching back, like, BBC, like, episodes of Top of the Pops of, like, 80s pop music. In the 90s and that, on like even the early 2000s, of being a bit younger than I am now, there was part of me that thought, like, you know, the 80s, oh, that was a bit shit. But it wasn't. It was just changing in a way of, like, it was actually all right.
Listen, every person is going to be nostalgic about their formative years. And what we're talking about here, so you're born 81, I was born 83, so I'm 37, 38. And I, you know, that every person, when we get to kind of our kind of age, is going to look back at that time of 16, 14, 15, 16, 17 as like the best time there ever was. And even if, like, and what's slightly depressing is that that's probably going to be the case now, where there's like maybe the music isn't, you know, isn't what it once was to some, you know, then that is going to, you know, you're just going to be fond of that because that's your formative years, right? So, but I do think there was a lot of special things happening in the mid-90s, and I think Oasis were at the forefront of that. And they were just exciting. They're exciting, and they were naughty, and they were, you know, controversial. And I love the fact they seem to not give a fuck. I find that such a quality I wish I had. And I see that in sports people as well, that kind of take it or leave it. You know, everyone else is trying their best and doing everything to reach this goal, yet take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You know, I love that. I just think that's so fucking, that is the epitome of cool for me.
Totally. And like the impact of Oasis that they had on me, the brothers, is just like, you know, obviously it's well documented that obviously when they were kids, you know, life wasn't particularly great, you know, and for the hard time that they have. And you know what? We both know that it was really shit, and they grew up in a hard time. But for what they went out to do and what they tried to do and what they achieved made me get up in the morning and think, like, you know what? I'm gonna be good. I'm gonna be good at what I do. I'm gonna dress well. I'm gonna, you know, have laugh. I'm gonna feel happy, and I'm gonna have some confidence. And it's just like, even to this day, and probably for the rest of my life, Chris, you know, I'm a dyslexic guy, and school was very tough for me. I can assure you of that. But because of the fan that I am of them, made me go out and get a job as a chef and go and work 14 hours and that, and put their music on when I've got all this stuff I've got to do. But all through my life, you know, even when you couldn't afford it, we made sure I had the money to go and see them, because they have, you know, given me everything in how the mind works, I suppose. And I'm so proud of that. It's just to be the fan that I am of them, but also with like many, many, many other bands. But just for them to give people hope. And I know there's so many people out there that still to this day, even right now while we're talking, that believe in that band so much. And it's like, you know, they've been and gone, and it's a $1 million question. But I just think, like, they had everything, you know, to give to people.
Yeah, and they're the only band I can think of that make the listener feel invincible.
Totally.
as a listener, you just feel invincible listening to them. It's such an interesting thing with them. So yeah, they give you that kind of confidence, I would say. And I think you're right, you know, given your circumstances. And I think they make you feel confident. You know, I would, if I was going out for a night, I would listen to Oasis beforehand, not just because I love the music, but it made me feel confident.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Such an impact they can have. And in regards to kind of like where they came from and stuff, I honestly think one of the charms about Oasis, and I don't know if anyone's really talked about this much, but they very much kind of conveyed themselves as kind of almost like councillor status, you know, hadn't had much of an education. They wore that on their sleeves. They would do things that, you know, they do naughty things and bad things in their drug tank, all that kind of thing. So they paint that kind of image of who they were, but then they would be like, oh, and here's the master plan.
Yeah.
And I think the charm was always that kind of like rose in a thorn bush kind of thing, which was like, oh, we're going to make the assumption that they're kind of just like the Sex Pistols, who are just like kind of like there to fuck stuff up and like be a bit gross and stuff like that. But then I think the MTV Unplugged show, the Mike Pro played, was an absolute, like, for me, that was a moment, which was quite late actually, because it was after Mastermind, Morning Glory had come out. That was when it was like, oh, fuck, these aren't just like hoodlums who are just like trying to, you know, upset parents and Daily Mail readers. They are beautiful songs. And it's just like, wow. And that's come from someone who hasn't gone to a music education school or hasn't, you know. And that, for me, was always the charm of Oasis. If they were a bunch of posh boys, they would never have landed in the same way as they did. It was that combination of like the lack of education they talked about, combined with like these beautiful. I remember where I was when I first heard the Master Plan, the song The Master Plan, which is still my favourite song of all time. I remember being like, oh, right, now this is a different thing. You know, this isn't just fucking cigarettes and alcohol and stuff like that.
No.
I want to pick you up on something that you said earlier that I slightly disagree with, which was you said that you like the fact they borrowed from other people. I actually think that really undermines them and it really irritates me. And I once got into a bit of a drunken argument with a guy called Dave Sardi, who produced because he produced Noel's first record, and I think the way that Noel and Liam to a certain degree reference the Beatles and reference the Stones and kind of rip off, like there's always one song on an album that is basically, all right, so the last Noel album is like, oh, let's Come Together, right, because you're basically doing Come Together, just like these little references throughout, I think really undermine how good he is. Like, he doesn't need to do that. Like, you're such a brilliant songwriter. You don't see Paul Simon or Neil Young or Bob Dylan, you know, just go, okay, well, starting from blank slate, okay, so I better, like, think about, okay, let's find a Beatles song and let's do it, you know, how can I do a version of it so it's kind of familiar to the listener? Like, you're so much better than that. And so I got an argument with Dave Sardi about this. And he said a really interesting thing to me. I said, because he said to me, he said, what's wrong with kind of showing your influence by the Beatles? And I said, well, nothing, but like, surely you can be independent and do your own thing. And, you know, because that gives ammunition for me to, for others to slag them off, or they're just a Beatles ripoff, man. And we got into a bit of a debate, and I said, and he said, what would you want me to do? And I said, well, I think you should tell him, stop ripping off the Beatles on the odd song. You just don't need to do it. And he said something very interesting. He says, as a producer, he said, you do not tell Noel Gallagher what to do. And I'm like, that's your fucking job. You're the producer. Like, you're literally being employed at that time to be the person who is like, actually, I don't think this is the right decision. And he went, you don't tell Noel Gallagher what to do. And I thought, well, what is the fucking point of being a producer then? If you've got one strong personality, well, you're just a yes man. Well, anyone could be a producer then. Yeah, I would say that the one thing that, because I know others will not go with Oasis and not get on board with Oasis because they'll lazily just go, well, it's a Beatles ripoff. Well, that's a ripoff of something else. And so it really kind of irritates me that, you know, say it's on the last album they did, which is basically Come Together.
Sure. You know, generally they are caring, loving people. They just want to be the best at what they do. And it's just like, you know what? You can, they can, you know, people go on about the arrogance of the, of them, and like, you know, they can tell someone to go and get fucked, you know, you're a fucking dick and you can go and fuck off, sort of thing. But out of all of that, you know, they were brought up by a single parent to be a caring, loving, genuine, decent person. And out of all of this, that is so important.
I can give you a little thing that I've not shared with anyone before, actually, about Liam that is really fucking cool. So I knew you can ask about Liam. So this is I've got the wristband here from when I was on the guest list at this Finsbury Park. And if you're on the guest list for a Liam Gallagher concert,
yes.
You have to pay £20 to a charity to collect your ticket.
Right.
So that says a lot about Liam.
Yeah.
He won't let you be enter, so he'll put you on the guest list, but you won't be allowed to enter the concert unless you pay £20 to charity.
And that's fair enough.
I mean, that says a lot about Liam. And he is a... he's, you know, there is a kind of front that we sometimes see, sure. A lot of which, that stuff in the papers, that was literally just publicity stunts.
Like, of course. Stunts. Yeah, yeah.
But he's a, you know, Christian Madden described Liam, you know, he spends a lot of time with Liam. He's Liam's kind of drinking buddy in the band.
Yeah.
And he said he's one of the most emotionally intelligent people you could ever meet.
Yeah.
He said he's one of the most emotionally intelligent people you'd ever meet.
Yeah.
So I think Liam, you know, for all of that kind of like tongue-in-cheek stuff, he's a very, very good human being.
And I totally believe that. I honestly believe that more than anything. It's just like from when you, put it this way, if we was to sit down with him now and have a pint, right? We could just literally talk about any kind of shit and just have, we'd be laughing. We'd be laughing our asses off because it would just be so relaxed. And it's just like, you know, it's how you come across as a person. It's just like, you know what, if, I suppose, like, this conversation that you could have, and it's just like, you know, I just get it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what it'd be like to have, but I've not had a pint. I've met Liam a few times, but I've not sat and had a pint with him. But, you know, we're hypothesizing what it'd be like. I think, I do know that he likes the escapism of that the band offers away from, like, fans. And so, you know, it's a real no-no to be like, oh, can you do a little video for my so-and-so family? Like, he gets that so much,
sure,
everywhere he goes.
Yeah.
And stuff that going for pints with the band and that kind of thing on days off and stuff like that, I think he really cherishes, because that's his family in a way, like his working family, and talking about music and stuff like that might not be his thing. And actually, I'll tell you something interesting, and this was on the podcast when I went to Barcelona to see him, and I was with Dan the drummer, and we did the podcast out there. He said this really interesting thing, that he was sat with Liam, and he said, you know, Liam said to Dan, who's much younger, by the way, said, what's the album that most kind of influenced you? And Dan said, Parachutes by Coldplay. And Liam was like, right, get that drink out of your hand. And like jokingly said, like, leave or something like that. And then Dan, he said, why is that? And basically Dan justified it as that was an absolutely integral album in his formative years. The very thing that we were saying, that shaped everything, shaped how he thought about music, shaped about songwriting, shaped about everything. And Liam went, you can have your pint back. Fair enough, all right, I'll give you that. So it's quite interesting that, you know, kind of going back, but we all are very nostalgic about our youth, but I just think we're very lucky that Oasis came about when they did in our youth.
Yes.
Fucking lucky.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there will probably never be a day, Chris, where, or a week or wherever, where, you know, their music will always be played in my life until the end. And I will always go and see them to the end. And they've had the biggest impact. I know we've said it, but it's just like how you can't express the words enough, I suppose, because When you go and see them, we're all there for the same thing. We're all there to have a drink. We're all there to have a good time. And we're all there to hear them tunes, like, obviously, when you go and see them live. But you know what? When we're not seeing them live, it's just like they just have the impact on our lives. It's just where it doesn't matter how many times you put the album on, it's still going to be the same of, like, when you heard it, you know, the first time you put it on.
I mean, it's a great night out. I mean, so my partner, as I mentioned earlier, my partner's Lithuanian, and like, she was very much camp normal, and still is to a certain degree.
Yeah.
We went to Finchley Park. She was like, wow, that was just so much fun. Like,
yeah.
And she was like, no, I'm Team Liam now. Like, and it was like, you know, she flips between the sides, and she's not a big kind of massive fan of all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But just interesting that, you know, I just pick you up on like not going to see Liam live. Like, I think you'll be surprised. All the things you just described there about having a great night, having a drink, just feels like a great event. And you do still experience that with the Liam gig. It's not quite the same as Oasis, but he still plays Fucking in the Bushes as he walks on, and you get that hysteria, and he'll come in and do Rock and Roll Star straight into Morning Glory. Then, you know, it's great. So I think you should kind of go and see
him. I will. And I'll tell you this, Chris, as well. It's just like from the time I got together with Susanna, we've seen, obviously, and Susanna's not seen Oasis, and she's not seen Liam, right? So I can't wait for us to go and see Liam together, and for Susanna to see Liam and hear them songs that Liam sings, because you know what? We've seen the other quite a few times together now, and it's just like, Susanna's from the Czech Republic, so her favourite music is Bob Dylan and Neil Young. And 2019, we went to see Dylan and Neil Young at Hyde Park.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool. But
I was lucky to see, I saw Dylan in Chicago a few years ago, and that was probably like 2000. And, well, I can tell you when it was. It was the day after Barack Obama got elected. No, re-elected as president. So hang on, that must have been like 2012, something like that.
Sure.
And it was this really funny thing when you see, you'll know this when you see Dylan live, but obviously he doesn't perform the songs as you know, anywhere near like they are on the record. And in American concerts, often they just don't check the tickets where you sit. So it was actually in this ice hockey stadium, and we basically just kept moving to the stage where we got kind of sat side stage, if you like, but not, you know, we didn't have special tickets, but just like as normal fans. And you had this situation where the right-hand side, so because all the fans were there, was singing the melody of the actual song. And Bob Dylan is singing a completely different melody with the same lyrics in the same time. And you had this really weird thing. And then being like a minute and a half into a song, knowing every single word and thinking, I don't know what song this is. I can't remember the name of this song because he did it in a completely different melody, which, you know, he does just to keep himself interested.
Sure.
He's a cool cat.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you another band, right? Okay, Chris. There's a band I've not seen live, right? But they're definitely on my list I want to see. And I know that you like them. What's your opinion on Radiohead, and have you seen them live?
I'm a massive Radiohead fan. So if you, over my shoulder here, I'm pointing to with a pen, this little thing here.
Yes.
Which, that was a birthday present to me. And that was from Clive Dima, who is Radiohead's live drummer. And he is close friends of ours. And we went on holiday twice with him last year when we could during lockdown, finally. So we went to his wedding as well. And they're going to come and visit us soon. And I was a fan of Radiohead, like, massively for years. And then Clive came on the podcast and we just got on like a house on fire. And since then, our relationship has blossomed. He really likes my partner's food, obviously. And we just go on holidays and stuff together. And it's really interesting being friends with Clive, because it'd be like going on holiday, you know, being close friends and then being, you know, going on holiday with like Bonehead or something like that, you know, because then you then really see, you know, get to know what the band really like and kind of hear all the stories and stuff.
Sure.
And you know, they are, you know, in fact, what I've got behind my head there is that's a cool story. So what this is an original print of a song by called Rabbit in Your Headlights, which is, I don't know if you know of Uncle. Have you ever heard of Uncle? UNKLE.
So Noel's done
a lot of, has got Uncle to do a lot of remixes for tracks. I don't know if you know an old song or an Oasis song called Who Put the Weight of the World on My Shoulders.
I know it.
And Uncle did that. So that's Uncle. So Uncle did a song called Rabbit in Your Headlights with Tom York. And I work in Brighton, which I've just moved to Brighton. So I was in London, but we moved to Brighton kind of 2 months ago. And I was doing some work in Brighton, staying in an Airbnb, and said I was down, you know, this host, this lovely lady, older lady, and she was very eccentric. And she said to me, oh, so you're here because you do music stuff? I was like, yeah, I do music stuff. She said, oh, my son's in a band, blah, blah, blah. And I'm honestly thinking that her son is just like in some little band. And then the longer the conversation went on, and she had like Uncle memorabilia around the house. And then I noticed her surname was Lavelle. And I was like, hang on, are you James Lavelle's mum? Am I staying in James Lavelle's bedroom? And she was like, yeah. She's like, you can't tell me you know my son. I'm just like, your son has had Richard Ashcroft, Noel Gallagher, Tom York. He's worked with David Bowie. He's worked with all these amazing people. Are you telling me your son's James Lavelle? She was like, I can't believe you know who he was. It made her night. And she gave me that print as an Airbnb, which I've now got, which is so cool. And I now live in Brighton, and I'm kind of concerned I'll bump into her in the road and she'll ask for it back. But anyway, so that's the Radiohead link with that as well. So Radiohead are a very, very important band to me. They have pushed boundaries massively around art. You could never listen to Radiohead twice and not hear something new, which I think is interesting for me. They are not depressing. You hear the word depressing thrown about with them at all. I find their music incredibly uplifting. I think, you know, I was not careful what I say because it was at a wedding not long ago when they were all there. And Phil, the drummer, if you look on my Instagram, the quote of the year is he listens to this podcast and Stage Left and said, described it as very, very inspiring, you know, inspiring and very informative, which is just like, fucking yes, mate. It's Phil Selway saying that.
Yeah.
I was well happy about that. I don't know if their music has evolved in the last, so they evolved a lot in their first kind of 10, 15 years up until Kid A and slightly beyond that, and did some great stuff. I love Amnesiac as an album, and they did some great stuff after that. I think since kind of 2010 onwards, I think they've kind of stuck to quite a similar sound and haven't evolved so much. I kind of want to go back to what they originally sounded like. But it's really interesting being friends with Clive because, you know, we went on holiday in Oxford and we drove to go and see Supergrass just before lockdown. And I'm the DJ in the car and Clive's driving. And I'm like, what do you play on Paranoid Android? And so I'm putting on Paranoid Android and he's like, which one's Paranoid Android? I'm like, Clive, you cannot be in fucking Radiohead. And he plays live parts. He plays the parts in the studios, played every single live gig with them since 2011. I'm like, you can't tell me you don't know what Paranoid Android is. And he's like, oh, it's that one. Yeah, I know. Okay, this is what I play. And just like hearing stories about touring the world with them and, you know, I'm picking out songs that he doesn't know because he was in Portishead. So Clive was a drummer in Portishead. And then he was Robert Plant's drummer and very, very nearly joined Led Zeppelin. So we're sat at a dinner table and at our old flat. And he was Robert Plant's drummer. And I don't know if you remember Led Zeppelin got back together to do some gigs at the O2.
Yes.
And what he shared with me is that Jimmy Page and Robert Plant nearly fell out again because they couldn't decide what drummer to have. Because obviously John Bonham had passed away.
Yeah.
Jimmy Page was like, we've got to have Jason Bonham because of the name.
Yeah.
And Robert Plant was like, no way. Clive Deamer is one of the most sophisticated and technically perfect drummers in the world. And that is accurate, by the way. We've got to have Clive. And Jimmy Page was like, no, we've got... And they nearly came to like, not blows over it, but like... So I'm sat at the dinner table. I'm saying, so you were one decision away from being in Led Zeppelin. And he was like, yeah, that's true. And he said, I don't know if I'd have done it. I was like, fuck. I'm sure he would have done. But so it's really interesting being friends with Clive because, you know, he's just a really interesting guy. He was in Portishead and he just, you know, he's brought something to Radiohead, which I think they didn't have, which was actually a lot of confidence and confidence in their own capabilities. I think Radiohead are seen as this kind of really technically gifted band, which they are, but I don't know if they believe that themselves. And I think there might be a lot of imposter syndrome going on with Radiohead. And Clive is incredibly technically gifted. So I don't know if you remember a guy called Ronnie Size, who won the Mercury Prize a number of years ago. And a lot of his music is like 170, 180 BPM. And he could never play live concerts because he couldn't find a drummer to play that fast for that long without getting knackered. And he found Clive after playing in Portishead. And he has a very particular technique that he learned from doing Tai Chi that he's approached, because he basically says that you shouldn't be playing drums and getting power through your arms, which is what most people do. Yeah. You get it through your wrists. And so he can play. So he'd be playing like for an hour, 170, 180 BPM. And Ronnie Sides was like, holy fuck, you're not tired. He's like, no, I'm fine. He's like, you're the only drummer I've met who's not, you know, out of breath. So Clive does a lot of technical stuff with Radiohead. And what he's brought to Radiohead, I think, is he's brought confidence in own capabilities, which I think maybe some of the rest of the band don't necessarily have. And it's really funny. We went out to Rome. My partner, Davila and I, went out to Rome in September when we could. And Clive and Lisa were in Italy at the same time. We're in Sardinia. And Lisa has got Italian roots. And we messaged him while we're there. And we're just saying, oh, so funny we can't meet up. And I'm getting in the cab, we're getting in the cab back to the airport. And it comes up on my phone, Tom York got married in Sardinia last night. And I was like, oh, that's why you were there. And they were like, yeah, we were at Tom York's wedding, but we had to sign a secrecy thing that we couldn't say that's why we were there. So it's really interesting to kind of know about the band and how they are. And they're incredible. And they'll be remembered as their Pink Floyd of their generation, in my opinion.
Absolutely. 1,000,000%. That hits the nail right on their head. To me, they're like a bunch of scientists, right, that create something that is pure genius. And it's just to the point where they're top on my list of when live music gets back. I'm hoping that over the next couple of years or so, they're going to play in this country and, you know, do something. Sure, they're not done yet. Surely they've got to do something, right? And I really want to, they're the one band I really want to see, you know? And I can honestly say, if I didn't go to another gig again and I only could pick one, it's them. Who I really, seriously, seriously want to see. My favourite track, I think, is Everything in Its Right Place. I love that. I think when Rainbow came out was pretty something for us, because I would have been in my 20s and life was okay at that time when Rainbow came out. I mean, I've got the greatest hits and I've got OK Computer and that, and the Bends, you know. Yeah. The Bends has been, you know, in Q Magazine a while back, you know, that was rated number one album of all time, you know, and it's just, what's second track? What's track two on the Bends?
Track two on the Bends would be, I should know this. I want to say it's the Bends. It is the Bends, isn't it? I thought the second track is actually the title track.
But the sound of that is just something. It's,
they're a great band. And you know, I said to Clive that, so a great night that I had, they headlined Glastonbury 2017, and I was working there. I was doing some work that weekend, and I had the most epic kind of 10 minutes because I met Noel Gallagher and he was really nice and we had a great photo. And I then could hear Radiohead playing, and I kind of ran to go and see Radiohead, and I didn't know Clive at this stage. And so I watched the whole concert.
Yeah.
And it was the best I've ever seen Radiohead play. And there was a really specific reason. And I've said this to Clive, I've said it's because Tom looked like he was happy playing the older stuff. Like it didn't seem like a chore. Like he was like, oh, right, I better play this, I better play that. He performed it. And I was saying about how epic that night was. And he said something really interesting. He was like, yeah, I do remember that night. But they played those nights. The next night they were playing headlining a festival in like Copenhagen. And 2 days later they're headlining a festival in another country. And whilst to us it seems like this big event, that just kind of was just what another night at work, basically, for them. But I do, I know that they would have, you know, the band would have taken Glastonbury particularly seriously. But it was just interesting that I was like, that's why that night was so special, that Tom wanted to play those songs or perform them, like it wasn't a chore. and they are great. I remember seeing them twice in two nights at Victoria Park in London, and they played a different set both nights. They didn't play one song twice.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. And actually, let me show you. See if you can work out what this thing is. I'm going to go.
Okay.
So this is a. So Clive got me this for my birthday.
Yeah.
See if you can work out what do you think that is?
It's a bit like a didgeridoo or something.
Looks like a didgeridoo. It's not a didgeridoo.
Is it harmonica?
No, it's not a harmonica. So a lot of people think because he's a percussionist, it's a percussion instrument. It's not. It's not an instrument. What do you think it might be?
I ain't got a clue, mate.
It is a acoustic amplifier to put your phone in and listen to music.
No way, that's really cool.
So it's an acoustic amplifier. So you can put your phone in there, listen to music, and you don't need to plug it in or anything. It amplifies
music. I bet it. And you know what, Chris? I bet it sounds amazing.
It does sound good. It's not bad, and I would say at least doubles the volume. At least. Probably a bit more than that.
Yeah.
But yeah, great band, love Radiohead, and I'll be looking forward to seeing them when they do stuff again, which hopefully they will.
Yeah, hopefully they will, because it's like, there's no doubt about it, what they could do. I mean, would they do Wembley? Do you reckon they could do that? Or would they want to do that?
Oh, they could definitely do Wembley Stadium, like, no
way,
something like that. It's interesting. Yeah, you're right. They've never played Wembley Stadium, have they? Whether they'd want to, I kind of think it'd be a very Radiohead thing to say, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Hyde Park.
Like, God knows. I don't know what venue they would play. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. They could play Hyde Park. I think that they think a lot about where they play. And
yes.
So if they would, they'd make that decision, they would prefer to play a smaller venue for two nights if they knew the sound quality was going to be better than doing one night's work and know the sound quality was bad. Like, I do know that Tom will, like, he will study set lists of when they last played that city and adapt the set list so that they don't get the same gig again and stuff like that. So they really care about where they play. And so maybe the reason they've not played Wembley Stadium is there's some kind of, like, it doesn't fit right, does it? Radiohead, quite an introvert band, playing the most extrovert venue in the UK. And equally, like, Hyde Park is known for having shocking sound quality, and it really does, because
yeah.
They kind of have it over a certain amount of decibels.
Sure.
So you just get, it's lost in the wind. If it's a windy day, you can't hear anything. So it wouldn't surprise me if they were like, no, we won't play there. So I think the last time they did London shows, they played like three nights in the O2.
Yeah.
You know, I think ideally they would just love to play like Royal Albert Hall, just like 10 nights.
Well, I'd be there. And yeah, I've been... what do you think about the Royal Albert Hall? Because I've been twice.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool venue. I saw the first ever performance of an Oasis song called "Hung in a Bad Place" there, it was an Oasis concert for, I think it was the first ever Teenage Cancer Trust.
Right,
and it was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. It turned up and it was like sitting in the school assembly. It was like we had these seats at the front. And it was like, what, an Oasis are going to fucking play there? You're kidding me. It was honestly like set out of school assembly, the way the seats were laid out.
Yeah.
Because they put these extra seating in. And they were like, oh, special. Roger Daltrey comes out, they're going to special support act just to get us going. And we're like, oh, who's this? Ashcroft comes out, plays half an hour of, like, yeah, just acoustically. It was like, right, that's a pretty bonus. And then Oasis came out and did, they played Hindu Times for one of the first times and hung in a bad place.
Would have been 2002, 2000.
And really liked, I mean, Royal Albert Hall was great. I saw Embrace there. I've been there a lot for other events as well that aren't music events.
Right.
Charity I work for, I do a lot of work for a charity, and they have like a, they used to have a mini box there. So there used to be a box that they used to, they've sold that now for the right reasons. I've been to the Royal Albert Hall for, I've seen like Cirque du Soleil there, like loads of different things. So, a friend of mine who lives down the road who I'm going to be having a pint with very soon.
Yeah.
He's a drummer and he's in a band called Bastille, who are quite massive, to be honest. And I was speaking to him, I think last week, about Royal Albert Hall. And he was like, it's fucking amazing. He's like, he said that, that was like life peak moment when you're on stage at the Royal Albert Hall. That's where you want to see most bands, I think. Certainly in London venues anyway.
Definitely.
Who did you see there?
Funnily enough, I've been twice and to see the Teenage Cancer Trust and Noel Gallagher both times. The first time I went was to see Noel just after Oasis of Split. He did two nights.
Acoustically.
And I was there on the Friday, right?
Nice.
And
I love those shows.
Yeah.
Is that what was released as Dreams We Made of Children? Was it those ones? The Dreams We Had as Children, which was like a bootleg that came out.
I think that was a bit of time before, but...
Right.
Yeah, I went on the Friday to see Noel and he had Gem... And he had Jay Darlington with him as well.
Yeah, and on drums would have been Terry Kirkbride.
That's right. Yeah. So that was the first time I went. The second time I went was for the Teenage Cancer Trust, where Chasing Yesterday, right? And I went with my cousin, and we were walking round the Albert Hall, and Mike was outside with Phil. I think I might have sent you the photo of me with Mike and Phil. I can't remember.
No, I've not got that.
Right. I'll send it to you. I was walking...
Wait, Phil who? So Mikey Rowe, yeah?
Yeah, and Phil, Liam and Noel's mate, DJ Phil.
Oh, yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah. So we was walking around the Royal Albert Hall, and I saw them two, and I'm just like, I've got to go and say hello, because obviously for the fan that I am, it's just like... is it possible I can have my photo taken with you? And of course, Phil's like, nah, fuck off. And I'm like, come on, man, I know who you are. And Mike is like, yeah, okay. So I had my photo taken with him. And the time I got two tickets. But when I got the two tickets, I literally phoned up the Royal Albert Hall because the internet was obviously fucked. So they said, yeah, you can have two tickets, but they're going to be separate from each other. And mine was right in the stalls about seven or eight rows back. And my cousin was sat literally on the side just by the stage or something. Right. It was brilliant. And to see him do them tunes in that building, you know, I think going to the Palladium and seeing Noel and seeing him at the Royal Albert Hall are things I'm quite proud of, because out of how many people love him, how many people can say that they've seen him there, you know? I think that's pretty cool. Obviously, I've seen Noel in Birmingham and obviously Oasis, but pretty excellent. I love to go and see... Who would I love to see in the Royal Albert Hall? Like today? I don't know. It's just like, I don't know who I'd want to see. If somebody said, pick a name out of the hat, who could you see at the Royal Albert Hall? I don't know.
Who do I want to see at the Royal Albert Hall? Do you know a guy called Benjamin Clementine? He's a really cool artist who did an album a few years ago that
is he a singer-songwriter on his own?
Yeah,
I think I know him.
Yeah, and so he he's just a really, I would say he's going, not in the same scale of what Bowie achieved, but I think he's a Bowie-esque like character. And I think he was a homeless in France and Paris, and started busking, and then got offered a gig and had to walk barefoot to this gig, which was, then he started realizing it was not walkable. It was like fucking the other side of the country or something. And he then busked to get to this gig, and it's kind of gone from there. He's, he's performed in Jules Holland and stuff like that. So you might've seen him on there.
Yes.
And there's a really good TV program called The Morning Show, which is with Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston, which is like a drama, which is really, really, really fucking good.
Yeah.
And they're just filming the second series now, and they use one of his songs as theme tune for the actual program as well. I'd like to see him there. It's just a cool venue. Very, very good for orchestral, bands as well, I'd say. Because you've got those big pots on the ceiling which kind of bounce around the sound. Which,
yes, know. Absolutely. I think, obviously, I'd like to see someone like Weller there, or one of the greats, maybe. The list, it's just endless, the list of, who you could see there. But I think I'm obviously biased. I just love going there to obviously see who I've seen there. It's just always really good. And I think when you go there, it's like, it feels like the creme de la creme of a venue when you see, your favourite, rock star in a venue like that. It just feels like one of them nights. Especially if it's on a Friday or Saturday night and you're in that place, when you see someone like, obviously, who we love, it's pretty, but Ashcroft, it would do an amazing gig in that place.
Yeah, Ashcroft, I've got stories about Ashcroft, which are just I remember, so I had Damon Minchella on the podcast, and Damon, very luckily, he just said, do you want to come to the O2 gig? And I was like, love to, put us on the guest list.
Yeah.
I went into the green room, and Ashcroft's there, he's just got off stage. Give him some time, And there was just a point where I was like, any chance of a quick photo? Just what happened before I said that? I said, my name's Chris, I'm on stage of podcast. And he cut across and he knew about the podcast.
Right.
Yes, I mean. I didn't have to finish what I was saying. He went, you had Tony Visconti on, didn't you? That's what he said. He said, yeah. He went, Damon was telling me about it. A nice one. my favourite, one of my, actually a great story, is my favourite ever Richard Ashcroft song. It's called Science of Silence. And I don't know if you know it. It's a track of the album he did that Brian Wilson performed on as well.
I'd know it.
Yeah, and it's perfect. It's one of my favorite, it's probably my top three songs of all time. And I was invited by, you talked about Jay Sharrock earlier. So yeah. Jim Sharrock and Abby from the Zoo Songs invited me up to Liverpool. And they went, we're going to have a night out, we'll take you out and stuff. I was like, fucking, this sounds brilliant. Get there, and I'm sat around this table, and it's like all the Zoo Songs are there. Coral's there, you got Lightning Seed over there, you got it was cool. And just sat this guy to my left, I didn't know who it was. And it was just like, okay, I'll better, say hello to him. And I should have known, it's got Martin Campbell, who's bassist in Lightning Seeds, but he's also, he's in Cast as well, and he's done loads of stuff. And he was Ashcroft's bassist. And I was like, mate, what era did you play with him? And we worked out, and I was like, did you play Silence? And he's like, yeah, I did. I was like, fucking let me buy you a drink right now. And then we've been really good mates ever since. And he had a big birthday recently, and I had to do one of those videos for him because he couldn't have the party. And every time I go up to Liverpool, we hang out. And whenever I get drunk, I'm just like, mate, you play bass on one of my favorite songs of all time. And we went back to Abby's place, and we all sat there quite late on. We were all very drunk.
Sure.
And I did that really kind of embarrassing fan thing where I said, Martin, I said, there's one performance of that song on CD UK. I said, I've got Jim's TV. I went, Jim, let me put on YouTube. So put on YouTube. I found it and I was playing it. And Martin looked absolutely, he was loving the fact that I'd remembered this performance. And Jim, the next day, when Martin loved that, he said, like, he really loved the fact someone remembered, you know, something that he'd done. Yeah. And it's really interesting because in Lightning Seeds, he wrote a couple of songs in Lightning Seeds, which are really deep cuts. Like, you probably can't find them now. So deep that even Riley, Ian's son, when I mentioned to him, was like, I didn't even know that. And Riley does everything for the Lightning Seeds these days. And we were backstage at one of their shows, and my best mate, Steve, said to Martin, he said, you did a B-side years ago called Open Your Eyes, didn't you? And Martin was like, yes, I did. And was like, let me pull up a chair and sit with you. And he just loves hearing people remember good stuff that he'd done. And he just like, I think these people are like bulletproof and just like, oh, I've got all these confidence and stuff.
Yeah,
Martin is a really confident guy. But it's just like, it was really lovely to see how us just remember. And Steve was like, that was one of the first songs I learned on guitar. He's like, the chords like C, F, G, E minor. And he's like, yes, they are. And he was like, I can't believe someone remembers this. So things like that are really, really special when you kind of interact with some of these guys. And Martin played with Ashcroft, which I keep forgetting. I speak to Martin quite a lot and I keep forgetting he played with Ashcroft. But he's a cool cat. And yeah, if your listeners don't know or viewers don't know that song, check it out. It's a beautiful, beautiful song.
I mean, from the 90s going into the 2000s and like having the American scene come over at the time, are you a fan of the American bands that came into the early 2000s?
Well, yeah, I'm trying to think who you mean then. So would that be like, I mean,
Strokes, White Stripes, it's King to Leon, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club.
Not massively, like, but not dislike them, but I appreciate them from afar. So I think like Queens of the Stone Age, like,
oh yeah,
fucking talented musicians in that band.
Mega band.
It's never been about what country they're from, to be honest. Like, it's never, there was an American. The scene I didn't like was the whole Limp Bizkit thing, like that.
No.
I found it really fucking, and I remember going to Reading on my 18th birthday, Noel Gallagher nodded at me on my 18th birthday, and I went, that weekend, Oasis 2000. Yeah, Oasis played, Ian Brown played, Embrace played, Muse played, Stereophonics played.
Yeah, Pulp.
And then going back there the year later and Limp Bizkit played, and it was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it was really noticeable. Reading had done a pivot and they were like, okay, now we're going to go to more American bands, which, you know, enough, that was their thing.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, I'm trying to think, American bands are like, I mean, I'm not sure, but I was fine. You know, I mean, Jack White is an outrageously talented musician. You know, I remember being on Glastonbury with White Stripes and him playing a really complex piano part with his right hand, and with his left hand, he had a bass guitar synthesizer to synthesize a complete, and it was like, well, and he's singing at the same time and performing. So, yeah, I mean, he's obviously really talented.
I'm a massive Jack White fan. Him and Noel are my two favourite people, I would say. Like, Noel,
Zorro on Donuts.
The what, sorry?
Do you remember Noel called him Zorro on Donuts?
Yes. And it's just like, I just think I got into when obviously that lot was all coming over and in the Enemy and Q and all of that. I just love Jack and the sound that he gives us and his lyrics, his beats, his sounds, you know, his voice. I think he's pretty unbelievable. I just think he's a very, very, very talented man. I missed out on the White Stripes, but I saw Dead Weather Raconteurs and I've seen him solo.
Nice, nice. Yeah, he's a cool cat. You know, he's a cool cat. He knows what he's doing, and I like his choices as well. He's quite restrained in, like, you kind of feel like he could be bigger than he is if he wanted to be, but he's choosing not to be.
Yeah, I don't think the White Stripes will ever get back together.
I mean, what does Meg do these days? Does anyone know?
I don't think they do. I don't think she's doing alive. Anything. The what?
She's alive. She's not like the wife of the guy who runs Scientology who questioning whether she's buried somewhere. Like he's like what no one's ever heard of Meg ever since. Like
no. I think she just like literally she's gone off and that's it, just away from everything.
She's done a Griggsy.
Yeah. Will we ever hear from him again? Probably not. Have you got any music coming up, like, with your solo stuff, and what's the plan with your own music?
Yeah, so thank you for asking. So, so I've been in bands for years and did some kind of cool stuff and released a record under the name Last Wilderness in about 3 or 4 years ago. And we actually had people from the podcast play. So we had Lawrence Juber, who was Paul McCartney's guitarist, who has won 2 Grammys. He played on one track. And we had Shane Keister, who is Elvis Presley's pianist, playing on another track. And since then, when I mentioned that to other guests, like just in passing, who've asked, they're like, yeah, I'll play on that. And so I've got this kind of, this long list of people who'd be up for playing on my record. And I just need to get around to do it. What's happened in the last year, the pandemic has, without going into too much detail, it's in a strange way, given some of the work that I do, it's created more work opportunities for me that I couldn't really say no to. So I do a lot of, basically I teach, I've got 2 or 3 jobs. One of them is I teach a master's. And other master's lecturers on the course that I deliver are slightly older than I am, in fact, much older, and aren't very au fait with using things like Zoom and using technology. So what happened was I was due to do a module last year and people complained a lot about the experience they'd had with others because they couldn't use Zoom like we are now. And it was like getting your parents' generation to do something. It was a fucking nightmare. So I, because I'm a bit more au fait with it, I was offered a lot more work doing a lot more delivery, basically, and I was offered a couple of other modules. So it's and that's on top of another kind of pretty much a full-time job. So, and doing the podcast. So basically, it's just, I need to get around to doing it. So yes, I will do stuff. I wrote a song called You Sketched Your Dreams on the Back of a Napkin about a year or so ago, and it was kind of testing myself because I got a first-class degree in professional musicianship and songwriting. And I was kind of like, I'd not written for a bit. And I thought, I wonder if I kind of still can, even though I'd not written for about 2 years. And I was booked to play a gig on the Saturday night and my partner was going out to work in the morning. And I was about to play the same old bloody songs, which go down well. I've done, you know, played 150, 300,000 times before. And I thought, I've got all day, it's 10 in the morning, I'm on stage at 8 tonight, why don't I write a new song today and play it tonight as a test, just to stretch me. So I did that, played it, went down well. I was then asked to play, I've never been one to play people's weddings and stuff. I paid me £500 to play a solo set at a wedding in the background music. I was like, fucking yes, I'll do that. And I then stretched myself by thinking, well, I've asked for a certain number of covers and some of my own stuff. The first song I'm going to play after she walks down the aisle is this new song. Just to see how that, and it was beautiful and it went down really well. And that will be the starting point from when we record a new album. So sure. It's me and my best mate, Steve. We'll have other guests on there, but that'll be like the first track. That'll be like, that's where we'll start with, because I know that it's a really strong track, because if it wasn't, I wouldn't be playing it at someone's wedding moments after them saying their vows and people saying it's good. So, so I'm looking forward to doing that. We'll probably just call it Last Wilderness 2, to be honest. So we're just going to kind of think. And it's just, I think it's going to be an ongoing project we'll do for a number of years. And I'd imagine there'll be guests on there from you know, people that we know from the podcast and stuff, which is exciting.
Thank you ever so much for everything, you know.
As Paul Gallagher said to me when I started the podcast, he said, go forth and conquer.